It is nice to be celebrating this festival with you here in Jekyll Island. The last time we were here, I think, was in 2022. Yeah, that's last year. I was just seeing if you were awake. I don't know. I'd like to begin today by sharing a quote with you. I actually have kind of a collection of quotes. Years ago, I started writing them down when it came to the point that the realization that I wasn't going to remember them any other way. So, the quote I want to share with you today is not from a great theologian. It's not from a philosopher. It's from a man known more for his action than his thought. His name is synonymous with the martial arts. The quote is from Bruce Lee. Here it is. When under duress, we don't rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. I'll give it to you one more time. When under duress, we do not rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. Now, this statement's a little sobering, isn't it? Because we have, all of us, great expectations. We have expectations about life. We have expectations about our future. We have expectations about the festival. We all have expectations. We're not the only ones with expectations. God also has great expectations for us. He can meet those expectations with a word, but that's not how it works. That's not how he works. Experience in life shows us that this is not how God does things. And honestly, it's not good for us when things come too easy. Any parent knows this and understands this. Now, we live in a society that places high value on comfort and convenience, and there's almost this sense of entitlement to have our expectations met. And when they're not met, we can feel slighted or cheated. Life isn't fair, we think. The hard fact of the matter is this. There are going to be times in our lives when our expectations are not realized. How do we handle this? Since I want to talk today about expectations, let's begin by considering a common expectation we all share, and that is the expectation about rejoicing at the feast. Deuteronomy 14:26, we've turned there already. It's where God basically commands us to rejoice. Now, we might think, great, this is a commandment that should come naturally to us. But that's not always the case, is it? What if you're having difficulty rejoicing because maybe you're not going back to a job? What if you're ill? What if you're worried about falling behind in school or at work? There are a great number of things that can weigh on our minds. These types of issues cause trials and distress, also known as duress. How then can we meet our expectation of rejoicing when we don't always feel that way? Is it possible to train to the level of our expectation? Because a connection is made in Deuteronomy 14, also referred to earlier, so I won't turn there, the connection is made between observing the feast and learning to fear the Lord always, which is a connection between what happens at the feast and what happens with us the rest of the year. So a connection is made there. The feast can impact our lives the rest of the time. Now, I do have a small confession to make. It annoyed me, used to annoy me more, every year when we would say, "This is the greatest feast ever." Now, I understand why we said that, because truth be told, In many ways, the feast is what we make it. We have some control over that. But realistically, not every feast was the best feast ever. Some were better than others. Some weren't. Sometimes our expectations were met, sometimes they were exceeded, and sometimes expectations fell short. By far, most feast experiences, our expectations were met. And on a few, expectations were exceeded. Great. I remember those. But you know what? I remember the ones that didn't meet expectation probably more than all, because the other ones that met expectations, they just become this homogeneous one great feast experience. But I do remember the ones that didn't meet expectations. 1981. My wife Linda and I were planning our second feast together as a married couple. We were also expecting our first child. So we were thinking, we're going to be going locally in the foreseeable future. So now's the time to go someplace, you know, exciting, exotic, fun. So we consulted with a couple of other young couples in our church area, and we decided, based on a recommendation, to keep the feast that year in Barbados, Caribbean island, tropical paradise, great restaurants. Your money goes farther there because of the exchange rate. Really friendly people. Sounded great. Sign us up. I will tell you, expectations were high. We got there. Some of the best restaurants were closed. The others were, eh. Our money didn't go any farther than it did at home, and that never seemed to be enough. The people were very nice, and it was a tropical island paradise. That was true. So the first opportunity we had to go to the beach, I remember standing there on the beach, soaking up the tropical island experience. The sun was out, the gentle ocean breeze was blowing, the trees were swaying magnificently in the breeze, blue sky, blue water. I was rejoicing in my heart over this, and I decided that I would like to rejoice in the water. So I ran into the water. About five steps in, I heard a little wave. My foot came down on something sharp, and I thought, yeah, that's probably not good. And I waded back out, and sure enough, I had laid my heel open from side to side all the way across, and it was bleeding pretty good. Long story short, one of the friendly locals shared some rum with me by pouring it on my wound. I wrapped it in a t-shirt, and then it was off to the hospital for stitches. Well, that pretty much ended the swimming and the beaching and the walking comfortably without pain, at least for a few days. Wasn't what we expected. Why did that happen? Why'd that happen to me? Was it time and chance? Time and chance happens to everybody. Was it correction? Did God think I was concentrating on the wrong things? Was it edification? Maybe I was doing what was right, but he just thought, you know, we're going to help him become better. Or was it just that 42 years later, God knew that I would need material for a sermon? It could be one of those things or all of those things. We don't know. The point is not to waste time thinking about why something happened. Just refocus on what's important. Some of the objects of our focus weren't in the picture anymore of our rejoicing. Deuteronomy 14 tells us that good food and drink, we can have the feast, that the feast is a part of our rejoicing. And we can add various activities to that. Today's family day, that's one of them. Bicycling, good meals, you know, all that we know. But when it comes right down to it, all those things are like the icing on the cake. The icing is good, but it's not the real substance of the dessert. A lot of times, young children, some of my grandchildren included, they eat the icing and ignore the cake. Maybe we have a tendency to do that sometimes. The icing cannot be the substance of our rejoicing. What is the substance? What's the cake? What is the cake? The spiritual reminders and lessons of the festival. You see, many of the nice things we look forward to at the feast, the physical reasons we celebrate over, well, they're not always under our control. There are hurricanes, car problems, illnesses. On and on we could go. Many of us have experienced these things, and there's probably more. What is under control, however, is how we control our minds. What do we do with that? And sometimes we need to train ourselves to refocus our attention on the real substance of the feast. What are some of those things that we are to be focused on? I'd like to turn to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, I'd like to begin in verse 41. You shall keep it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in all your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. God wanted them to remember that he made or caused them to dwell in booths or shelters when they came out of Egypt. Now, obviously, the temporary nature of this comes into play, but I have something else I'd like to throw out there. There were roads in the ancient world, well-traveled roads, highways, well-established trade routes. They knew this. How do you think the Israelites felt when God took them off-road into the desert? And then things started to get bumpy. I think it might have went something like this. God, we know you're driving, but I think you might have made a wrong turn. Definitely, wrong turn. God doesn't make wrong turns. When he tells them that he brought them out and they're to remember that he caused or made them to dwell in booths, is part of that him saying, look, I want you to dwell in temporary shelters and booths when I brought you out of the land of Egypt because you thought that I was making a wrong turn? Didn't you? Where are you now? You're in the land of promise. I got you here. You didn't think you were going to make it here. I got you here. Trust me. I can get you anywhere you need to go. I can accomplish every purpose that I propose. Trust me. The Israelites were on their way to something better, better than where they came from. It's important to notice that they were going to get there because God was going to bring them there. God took care of them and provided for them in the wilderness. Now, opinions vary on how many Israelites were actually in the wilderness. The number doesn't matter. If we take the lowest estimate, we're still talking about tens of thousands of people. Tens of thousands. God provided food when there was none. He kept their clothing and shoes from wearing out. He provided water when there was none. They wouldn't have survived the journey without his intervention. You know, if we think about the miracle of the water being provided, let's pause and think about that for a minute, because I think sometimes we can't fully appreciate this because of the world in which we live in, where we go and we open up a tap and there's drinking water there. We can even have hot water if we want, cold and hot running water. That hasn't always been the case. This was a miracle. Sometimes I like to look for what I call the miracle within the miracle. What do I mean? Well, God not only provided water, he provided good water, and he provided water that stayed good. For an example, the American Civil War. Many of us have read about it, the horrific battles, the casualties. If you and I were Civil War soldiers, we would be more likely to meet death from the water we drank than anything that would have happened on the battlefield, because dysentery was the number one killer of Civil War soldiers. That's mind-boggling. But how long do you think it would take for a large group of people to contaminate an otherwise good water source, especially when you bring livestock into the mix? There's more to this miracle than meets the eye. Now, it's also important to remember that just because God took care of Israel, it didn't mean they didn't have difficulty. Scripture shows us that part of the difficulty was because God was part of their lives. Let's notice Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness. Why? To humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you and allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Your garments didn't wear out on you, neither did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know then in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Something like this is repeated in Proverbs 3 and also quoted by the writer of Hebrews in chapter 12. Now we are also on a journey, and God is bringing us to a better place. And James 1 kind of brings it into the New Testament focus that yes, even though that's the case, we still have difficulties. James 1, verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Difficulties can be a good thing. The reason God was bringing Israel to the promised land was he was revealing himself through them to the nations. A large part of that revelation was in how God miraculously delivered them through the wilderness. Without God's intervention, you die in the wilderness. You don't survive. Do you think the nations round about them knew that? Knew what a powerful and great God Israel had to sustain them in an environment that causes certain death? My wife and I like to watch the History Channel series Alone. I don't know if you're familiar with that. If you're not, they take 10 contestants, survival experts, and they put them out in the wilderness in a very inhospitable environment, and they're supposed to survive. And the last one, standing, gets a substantial cash prize. Good motivation. I think it's in its 10th season now, and I have to say that of all the contestants that won, I would say one, maybe two, I felt could continue to sustain themselves. Everybody else basically starved, and they were starving too, and they didn't have injury, and they didn't have sickness. It's quite remarkable when you think about it, because people die. They starve. The contestants on that show started starving almost from day one. It seemed like the new strategy was, we'll bulk up 20, 30, 40 pounds so we have a cushion because we're going to starve. And they did. So not only was God supplying their needs and bringing them to a better place, but God was actually including them in his plan. They weren't just beneficiaries of God's intervention, they were becoming participants as well in this process. Look at Deuteronomy 4. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 4, 5. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? They were to be an example. They were to be an example to the rest of the world. God was including them in his purpose. Let's notice a scripture in Isaiah 40. This is God asserting his sovereignty. Isaiah 40, verse 13. Excuse me. Isaiah 40, 13 says, who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? It's kind of a rhetorical question. Who counsels God? Answer, no one. How are you qualified to counsel someone who knows everything and declares the end from the beginning? And such a person does not need counsel. God doesn't need counsel. Yet, it seems from Scripture that he both has a counsel and solicits counsel. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 18. Second Chronicles 18:18. This is Micaiah the prophet. It says, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and his left. The Lord said, who will persuade Ahab, king of Israel, to go up, that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead? So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. What's going on here? He's soliciting counsel, but he doesn't need counsel. What's happening? He is bringing people in to his process. He doesn't need it, but he's doing it because that's what he does. God's inclusive. He's looping them in. He loops us in. He looped Israel in. Today, God reveals himself through Christ. Our part is to assist in that revelation, not only when things go well, but more importantly, when things don't. To present a distorted health and wealth type gospel wouldn't be truthful. When we are under duress is when we can shine the light of God at its brightest. This doesn't just happen. Not like walking in a dark room and throwing a light switch and there it is, the light. We can't throw a switch and reflect God's light at will. It has to grow. It has to grow and develop in us. And God develops in it. Over time, God helps us develop the patient endurance to encourage others by our example, mostly. You know, the analogy of fruit of the Spirit. Fruit grows over time. It develops. God includes us in his purpose of restoring his kingdom. Another area of substance that I want to focus on briefly, and that's brought out in a number of days in this festival. If you do a Bible search for the eighth day or eighth day, you're going to find a number of eight-day periods of time. Other than the feast, there are almost always a seven-day period followed by an eighth day. The seventh-day period almost exclusively is about purification and consecration. Purification and consecration. Now, it's not an eight-day message, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, but I do want to go to Leviticus 8 and just refer to one thing. This is where Aaron is being invested as high priest. So there's a lot of ritual going on here. But the part I want you to notice is that Aaron had to remain in the tabernacle for 7 days. We find that in Leviticus 8, verse 33, "And you shall not go outside the door of the tabernacle of meeting for 7 days until the days of your consecration are ended." For 7 days, he shall consecrate you. The eighth day, he was invested as high priest. But the 7 days of purification and consecration should tell us something. It should tell us that we're being invested for something as well. What would that something be? What's our investiture for? Revelation 5. Revelation 5, beginning in verse 9. "And they sang a new song, saying, 'You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on earth.'" We don't even know. We can't even comprehend the fullness of what this means. What it means to be a king priest. Christ is a king priest. Aaron the high priest was a priest. David was a king. Those offices were kept separate. Christ is the only one that combines those offices. And then we are also king priests. We are in the process of being consecrated and purified to become something higher than our highest expectations. That's the substance of our rejoicing. The extras are nice, but what God's purpose is for us is the true essence of the feast. The lesson of learning to properly rejoice at the feast is something we need to keep in mind throughout the rest of the year. After all, rejoicing isn't only for the feast. Following Christ isn't always easy, but it's always something to rejoice in. We should be able to find something to rejoice in no matter what, because of what's coming for us. If we keep our minds trained on God's purpose, we have high expectations. If under duress, we fall to the level of our training, then we must train to the level of our expectations. Fortunately for us, we have a trainer, and that is God. We don't have it in us to train to that level, but God will get us there. He has promised to. He will help us. Remember that our problems are a temporary part of life that God uses to work in us and show others what it's like to reflect Christ. God includes us in his purpose and is purifying and consecrating us to participate in that purpose. What's that purpose? The establishing of his kingdom forever.